It's a great honor, delight to be here with you to talk about this question, which is both more timely than ever, deeply controverted, very difficult. It's the thesis of my remarks today that evil operation and evil cooperation are isomorphic. That is to say that the analysis of the nature and structure of human action, enabling us to place acts in their moral species, provides the basis for an analysis of the same type regarding cooperation with evil. Further, most differences about just what constitutes wrongful cooperation with evil derive from prior differences regarding the analysis of the human act. Thus, almost all my time will be preoccupied with analysis of operation. Only at the end will I turn to cooperation. First, I will give an account of end, object of the external act, and circumstance, and treat of the different senses of intention and of choice. This involves identifying potential errors regarding the nature of the object of the external act. It also requires a treatment of the order of the object of the external act to the intended end, because this order for St. Thomas Aquinas determines whether an action is unified in its moral type or species. As, for example, when we say that the several acts involved in a life-saving surgery all are medical and good, or alternately, whether an action is disjunct and disunified in its species, as when we say that a thief who commits adultery for the sake of theft is guilty of two different kinds of evil, namely adultery and theft, and not merely of different modalities of theft. Second, having addressed operation, I will turn to the issue of the nature of cooperation with evil. Here I will briefly consider a common understanding of cooperation with evil that in part proceeds from an interpretation of the teaching of St. Alphonsus Liguori. I will also argue that this reading is not only inconsistent with St. Alphonsus's teaching, but that it is founded on prior difficulties in the analysis of the nature of operation. Thirdly and finally, I will conclude by proposing what the analysis of human action implies regarding cooperation with evil, offering one illustration from recent memory. St. Thomas very famously understands the moral act in terms of end, the object of the external act, and circumstance. Generally speaking, the end is that for the sake of which a thing is or acts. Correspondingly, intention, as Thomas puts it, is an act of the will with respect to the end that is of such a nature as to require further determination of means. Because, as Thomas puts it in Summa Theologiae, question 12, article 1, ad 4, when we say that we intend something, we mean not merely that we will have it, but that we will have it by means of something else. It is important to note that there are different senses of intention, but if we speak of action, there is one distinctive end without which there will never be an action. For example, suppose that I am weary at the end of a long day and sunk in my chair, indisposed to move. My wife admonishes me that one of our children is ill, but that we seem not to have the cough syrup we need, and that I should drive to the store to obtain it. So I must get up from my chair. I must find my keys. I must be sure I have my billfold and money or credit card. I must go to the door. I must open the door. I must go out and then shut the bloody door. I must walk to the car. I must open the door. I must get in. I have to shut the door, and so on. All these intermediary actions are, in a way, intermediary ends toward which I must move. And in a sense, I intend them all. On some analyses, this makes all the elements of the moral act intentional in exactly the same way from top to bottom. But yet, if my wife shouts to me as I begin to start the car, "Honey, you don't need to go, I found it," my motion, I assure you, ends abruptly. I will not go to the pharmacy to obtain the medicine. This is because these intermediary ends are not in the most causally pertinent sense the end of the action, And if I no longer intend that end, then all subordinate ends vanish. Thus, while in one way every part of the motion to the end can be designated as an end and as intended, this ought not to conceal from us the unique and causally primary sense of end as that for the sake of which the whole action is ordered. Intention is not univocal between the intending of the end of the action as such and the intermediary objectives willed for the sake of that end, precisely because this causal primacy is not shared with subordinate objectives. So the primary sense of end in relation to human action is precisely that for the sake of which the particular action is chosen and performed. In a secondary way, we may speak of any part of the motion to the end as intended, and likewise we may speak of the object of the external act as intended. But without the primary and causally unique sense of intention, there will never be an act, never be any motion to the end, nor be an object of the external act, because there will be no act. As Thomas says in Summa Theologiae Prima Secundae, question 12, article 4, intention is principally of the end and choice of the means. Quote, accordingly, insofar as the movement of the will is to the means, as ordained to the end, it is called choice. But insofar as the movement of the will is to the end, as acquired by the means, it is called intention. A sign of this is that we can have intention of the end without having determined the means, which are the object of choice, end quote. Yet nonetheless, there is a derivative sense in which the means chosen are intended. A moment ago, I mentioned the object of the external act. Differences in understanding this with respect to operation are perhaps responsible for most of the dissensus regarding the nature of cooperation with evil. According to St. Thomas, in Summa Theologiae Prima Secundae, question 18, article 2, add 2, the object of the external act is what the act bears upon, not the matter of which a thing is made, but the matter about which something is done. Or as he says in question 18, article 6, quote, the object of the external action is that on which the action is brought to bear, end quote. Further, the object of the external act, according to St. Thomas, has a species or a moral type. The type of an action as to whether it is good or evil and in what way. Something Thomas makes clear in many places, especially question 18, article 5, and question 18, article 7. Because the good or evil of the object is an essential difference in relation to reason, as Thomas teaches in question 18, article 5, the object of the external act, and indeed the action taken as a whole, bears an essential relation to reason. Moreover, what an act bears upon includes the manner in which it bears upon it. Thus, theft, commerce, barter, and simple appreciation may bear on the same property, but they describe different objects of action. Thus, one may appropriately define the object of the external act as what the act is about in relation to reason. The relation to reason is formal and makes reference to the ratio or reason under which some action is or ought to be considered choiceworthy or preferable by the agent as a way of moving toward an intended end. But the object of the external act necessarily includes not only this relation to reason, not only the ratio of appetibility, or what makes the action desirable to the agent, but also its integral nature and its essential or per se effects. This is because the integral nature and per se effects of action are part of what we embrace in choosing to act in a particular way for the sake of some end. Our choice reaches out not only to what makes an action attractive to us, but extends to the action itself, which accordingly ought to be choice-worthy. The object of the external act is said to be something formal, but it is formal not in the way that the soul, as a formal part of human nature, is formal, but in the way that essential nature is said to be formal, as a whole. In physical things, the essential nature includes both form and matter, and this essential nature is itself something formal, as things are formally distinguished by their natures. Similarly, the object of the external act includes not only a formal relation to reason and appetite, but also the integral nature and per se or essential effects of the action chosen. Were one to exclude the relation of reason from the object of the external act and consider only the physical causality of the action, the object of the external act would not properly be a human act, because the object of the external act then would not be considered as essentially voluntary. Action is voluntary only as known and willed. To exclude the relation to reason, the relation to the ratio of appetibility under which an agent prefers one way among others to move to the end, or at least consents to the choice-worthiness of an action, if there is only one way to move to the end, would reduce the action to a mere physical externality in relation to the agent. Further, while we may know something essential about the goodness or choice-worthiness of an action, simply owing to its essential causality, even so, one always has a fuller and more complete account of an agent's action by considering the reason why the agent finds an act preferable. Such an account may indicate that the action is either worse or perhaps marginally better than is evident from its causality alone. But to repeat, the action would not even be a human act without the essential relation to intellect and will. Further, when we speak of the object of theft, this makes reference to it inclusive of the action itself and its nature, but also inclusive of the aspect under which the act is preferred or accepted by the agent. The object of theft, physically construed, could also be an object of barter or of commerce. To refer to an object of the external act as theft is to refer to the manner in which the action lays hold of the property, not merely to the property. The relation to reason cannot be excluded from the object. Thus, removing the relation to reason from the object would be an error of physicalism in the treatment of human action. On the other hand, it is far more common today for it to be thought reasonable to exclude the integral nature and essential effects from the object of the external act. These are thought to be merely physical, whereas what the agent is responsible for is thought to be exclusively the rational and human aspect under which one prefers this or that action. But there is more in the act we choose than simply that which makes it preferable to ourselves. In addition, there is the causality of the act, which, since we are willing to perform it, ought to be worthy of choice. We do not choose merely that which makes an act preferable to us. We choose the act itself, which is of such a nature and such an essential causality. For an act to be good is not merely for there to be some basis for the agent to prefer it. The act itself needs to be essentially good. One imagines a person in line for life-saving therapy with several people ahead of him in line. He realizes that his prognosis makes it dubious he can receive treatment in time unless he can jump ahead in the queue. So he tries to persuade those in front of him in line to leave the queue. Perhaps he's wealthy and offers a very great deal. Yet all the others are in the same boat as he is, and they refuse. In trying to persuade such people to abandon their position in the queue for benefits received, he may grow to appreciate and like these people very much indeed. Perhaps such an agent would be terribly torn. if such persons would not abandon their positions in the queue, and he would need to remove them forcibly. If finally he decides to take each person who needs to be removed from the line in order to permit him to get his therapy in a timely way, and to walk that person down a dark alley, only to return by himself alone, he cannot then reasonably say, I'm not committing murder, I'm merely removing impediments to life-saving therapy. It may indeed be the wrongdoer's intention to access life-saving therapy, and the ratio of appetibility for his action indeed may be merely to remove impediments to getting life-saving therapy. Nonetheless, the object of his external action is wrongful homicide. Indeed, wrongful homicide is removing impediments to life-saving therapy for the sake of saving his life, but wrongful homicide. Similarly, take the case of a man with high blood pressure afflicted by his in-laws who perpetually visit, and he cannot be rid of them. When they visit, his blood pressure rises precipitously and dangerously. Suppose they persist in visiting, no matter the impediments, with dire consequence for his health. If he should decide to address his problem with lethal means, and by doing so actually succeeds in lowering his blood pressure, nonetheless, he has not performed a medical act, even though the action had a good medical effect. This is because, A, those on whom he operated were not medical patients, B, they were harmed, not medically helped, and C, he not only harmed them, he killed them. There may indeed be a circumstantial relation between removing his in-laws and lowering his blood pressure. Perhaps after the murder, his blood pressure goes down and stays down. But murder does not essentially tend toward the reduction of the murderer's blood pressure. The relation is circumstantial. Indeed, the act terminates in someone in such a way as to harm and not to heal. It is in no way a medical act, however much circumstances may render it medically beneficial. One might note the same of craniotomy performed to save the life of a mother whose child is stuck in the birth canal, something that still happens in places where cesarean section isn't feasible. It isn't the case that killing a child of its nature is a medical act, as it terminates in someone who is not the patient and does so in such a manner as to harm and indeed kill the one in whom the act terminates. Reduction of the object of the external act to the ratio of appetibility of the agent in preferring it turns the object of the external act into a purely intracognitive event, a mere description or proposal which need not include the essential character of the action knowingly and voluntarily embraced. This is commonly referred to as intentionalism because the ratio of appetibility to which it reduces the object of the external act stands very close to intention. By contrast, the act itself, its integral nature and its per se effects are necessarily included in the object of the external act. All of this presupposes knowledge and voluntariness. As I've already noted, Thomas expressly considers the relation between the moral type or species derived from the object of the external act and the moral species derived from the end, which Thomas clearly distinguishes in many places, among them question 18, article 7 of the Prima Secundae of the Summa Theologiae. Thus, it is clear that for St. Thomas, the object of the external act does have a moral species or type. In recent years, this itself has become a disputed proposition. One rightly renowned scholar, Father Martin Roenheimer, has argued that according to Aquinas, there is not and cannot be a moral species derived from the object of the external act that is distinct from the species derived from the end, because this would fracture the unity of human action. Thomas, however, in speaking of the goodness in human action, writes, quote, accordingly, a fourfold goodness may be considered in a human action. First, that which as an action it derives from its genus, because as much as it has of action and being, so much has it of goodness as stated above. Secondly, it has goodness according to its species, which is derived from its suitable object. Thirdly, it has goodness from its circumstances, in respect, as it were, of its accidents. Fourthly, it has goodness from its end, to which it is compared as to the cause of its goodness, end quote. Since he lists the goodness according to the species derived from its suitable object as distinct from the goodness derived from its end, to which it is compared as to the cause of its goodness, it would seem that for Thomas these are different. After all, when taking my wife to dinner, I don't order a table for four on the grounds that there's myself and my wife and my wife and myself. Clearly, these are listed as distinct elements. Given that there is this diversity of moral species, or to put it differently, given that there is a moral species derived from the object of the external act, from what the act is about in relation to reason, and also a moral species derived from the end intended by the agent, there must be some relation between these two types. In question 18, article 7, Thomas teaches that when the object of the external act is essentially or per se or ordered to what the agent intends, then the species from the object is contained within the species from the end as an essential determination of that species from the end. It's like Russian dolls inside one another. Where these objects are all essentially ordained to the end, their species is contained within the species from the end. But when the object of the external act is only accidentally ordered to what the agent intends, then the moral type or species derived from the object is disjunct from and not contained within the species derived from the end. And the illustration here we have already mentioned, which Thomas refers to either as theft for the sake of adultery or using the illustration of adultery for the sake of theft. So to take the latter case, a thief wishes to simulate intimacy with a mark because this enables the thief to gain access to private quarters and crack a safe at leisure without fear of discovery. Because adultery is not essentially ordered to theft, even though the reason for this adultery is theft, there are two distinct and disjunct species because adultery isn't essentially ordered to theft. Circumstantially, and in the mind of the agent, perhaps the adultery is only a means to theft. But by reason of the per se effects and integral nature being included in the object, this agent is guilty both of thievery and of adultery. On the other hand, consider the case of using anesthesia medically in surgery. By its nature, always or for the most part, anesthesia will essentially aid the medical purposes of quieting the patient during surgery and relieving pain. Thus, its use in this case is essentially medical. And in this case, it is per se ordained to the surgical act. The species from the object giving anesthesia is contained in the medical species derived from the end. It's important, however, to realize that to say the object of the external act is essentially ordered to the end intended by the agent isn't to claim a unique and exclusive relationship. Anesthesia may be per se ordered to medical action in one case, but it may also in another be per se ordained to abduction. In human action, the natural teleological order and the logical and intentional orders meet in a sui generis way. Just as when we say that animality belongs per se to man, this does not mean that every animal is man, or that no other species is per se animal. So when we say that an object is per se ordered to an end, this doesn't mean that such an object can't be per se ordered to any other end. The same essential causality that renders the use of anesthesia and medical surgery to be per se ordained to the medical intention of surgery enables it to be per se ordained to kidnapping in an abduction. The same surgical cutting that may be per se ordained to major heart repair may also be per se ordained to torture, humiliation, and murder by Jack the Ripper. To take a more topical example, the high-dosage contraceptive pill may be taken specifically for contraceptive purpose and can be per se ordered to this intention, but it may also be taken by a woman with no intention or choice of any venereal act for the purpose of regulating the cycle. It may likewise be per se ordained to this end. obviously, if the woman chooses the action for the sake of contraception, that it regulates the cycle is irrelevant. Likewise, obviously, if the woman chooses the action to regulate the cycle, its contraceptive character is not necessarily pertinent. What is in question is the relation of the object of the external act to the end, and where the object of its nature essentially tends to what the agent intends, then the species derived from the end contains the species derived from the object as an essential feature. This cutting is medical. That cutting is torture. This use of anesthesia is medical. That use of anesthesia is abductive. Because we only know per accidens ordering by contrast with per se ordering, and because knowledge is required for voluntariness of action, ordinary knowledge of natural order is presupposed to evaluating actions. Per se here does not mean good. Per accidens does not mean wicked. We're simply speaking about the natural causal relation between what an agent chooses and what an agent intends as an end. Where the object is not per se ordained to the end, its species isn't contained in the species derived from that end. For example, adultery for the sake of theft isn't merely a form of theft. There is a circumstantial order in that case, but while the plan in the mind of the agent may be simply about theft, nonetheless, essentially, adultery does not tend to theft, and there are two species of wrongdoing and not only one. Where there is per se order, the species from the object is contained within the species derived from the end. The circumstances of an act, what surrounds the act, are, as it were, its accidents. Yet Thomas teaches that a circumstance may so affect the object of the external act as to render it to be the principal condition of the object and change its moral character or species from good to evil. And then it isn't acting merely as a circumstance anymore. Take an example of the effort of prisoners of war in a POW camp in World War II. Their plan hinges on a prisoner who had been an Olympic sprinter being able to run fast enough and far enough, eluding the lights, to get to a place where a cable is accessible by digging, the severing of which will turn off the lights in the compound. This is aimed at making it possible for the pre-selected escape group to cut the wires and escape without being immediately observed and machine-gunned. However, the night before the escape is planned, the sprinter sprains his ankle and it swells up like a grapefruit. What was a reasonable plan has now become unreasonable owing to a circumstance. The circumstance has become the principal condition of the object in relation to reason. And so the attempt is no longer something reasonable to pursue. Not an attempt at escape, but a suicidal act by reason of the principal condition of the object. In a way, such a case introduces a new object. Not running swiftly, but running in a deficient manner has become the object, and accordingly, the act is unreasonable. Thomas teaches in Summa Theologiae Prima Secundae, question 18, article 4 and 3, that goodness is from integral causes. The end, the object, and the circumstances must be good if the object is to be good. A good intention cannot license an object that is essentially disordered. Thus, an action is most formally wicked when the end sought by the agent is wrongful, because the end has the greatest causality with respect to the action. When the intended end is good, but the chosen object of the external act is evil, this act also is formally evil, although it could be worse were it conjoined with an evil intention of the end. Finally, action may be wrong because the circumstances are bad and are so defining as to be a principal condition of the object, alter its essential causality and formal relation to reason, and in a sense thus introduce a new object. The principle of double effect is, in a sense, a test to help determine whether a bad circumstance of an otherwise good act is so bad as to become the principal condition of the object and so change its species from good to evil. Having considered operation, it is now time to talk about cooperation with evil. In doing so, it seems to me important to point out what is a common problem regarding cooperation with evil founded on what I would deem to be a prior error concerning the nature of good and evil action. This is the view according to which cooperation with evil is only formal when the cooperating party intends what the evil agent with whom he is cooperating intends. This is the problematic view from my point of vantage. If one does not share this intention of the agent, but provides cooperation integrally necessary to the evil action, on this view, one cooperates only materially, and it remains to be determined whether the material cooperation is proximate, so close to the evil as to be wrongful, or remote, that is to say, so indirect or marginal as to be permissible. On this account, such material cooperation may be justifiable, whereas formal cooperation with grave evil is always wrong. In its emphasis on intention alone, this account of cooperation appears to remove the integral nature and per se effects of action from the object of the external act. For this very reason, the diagnosis of intentionalism seems to be justified. The consideration of sharing the intention of the malefactor as definitive for formal cooperation is partially derived from a misreading of the work of St. Alphonsus Liguori, the patron saint of moral theology. St. Alphonsus famously writes, quote, "But it is better with others to say that that cooperation is formal which contributes to the bad will of the other and cannot be without sin. But that cooperation is material which contributes only to the bad action of the other beside the intention of the cooperator," end quote. Father Kevin Flannery, in his essay, Two Factors in the Analysis of Cooperation with Evil, observes in the following extensive citation, quote, "This certainly sounds as if, Alphonsus were saying, that one cooperates formally with a malefactor only when one shares his intention. Otherwise, one cooperates only materially. This certainly sounds as if, Alphonsus were saying, that one cooperates formally with a malefactor only when one shares his intention, otherwise one cooperates only materially. Thus, a pro-life nurse who must participate in an abortion or lose her job would cooperate in the abortion only materially, since her intention would be only to keep her job. Some of those who would call the nurse's cooperation material would also say that it is immediate material cooperation and for that reason immoral. But they would also have placed the nurse's action into a category of actions that could be moral, depending on the nature of the actions and their closeness to the action of the malefactor." Flannery continues, "This understanding and use of Alphonsus's central distinction is, however, incorrect, for it fails to appreciate the difference presumed by Alphonsus between the will of the malefactor and his intention. Alphonsus says that formal cooperation contributes to the bad will, voluntas, of the other, and that the material cooperator does not share the same intention, intentia, with him, the malefactor. But this says nothing about whether formal cooperation necessarily involves sharing the intention of the malefactor," end quote. He cites Alphonsus regarding the case of a secretary to a nobleman who might, out of fear of grave punishment, either write or even merely deliver amorous correspondence to his master's lover. Alphonsus holds that that secretary cooperates formally in evil and does so even if he merely delivers the correspondence and does not write it. In other words, it appears that what is in question is essential and direct aid with respect to the object of the wrongdoer's external act. To share in the bad will of the malefactor can occur when one voluntarily provides essential aid to the action of the malefactor, even if one has a different or even opposed intention with respect to the end of the action. Alphonsus gives another example of a lookout for a thief or an assassin and observes that such cooperation is intrinsically evil and can never be licit, even if done only under the fear of death. Yet clearly in such a case, the cooperator does not share the agent's intention of the end. while yet the chosen action would provide essential aid to the action of the malefactor, making the cooperator a co-agent of the object of the external act. Thus, there seems to be a formal contribution to the bad will of the agent on the part of the one who cooperates by essentially contributing to his action, even if he does not share the evil intention of the agent. In conclusion, the correct analysis of cooperation with evil seems to be this, that one most formally cooperates with evil in voluntary action that is predicated upon a shared wrongful intention of the end, that one nonetheless does formally cooperate with evil in voluntary action that integrally and essentially contributes to the external object of the evil agent's action. Understanding also that circumstances can become the principal condition of an object, and so can formally alter the moral species of the object of the external act. One materially aids an evil action only when the aid is indirect, although such material cooperation may still be evil. Our recent experience with the affordable healthcare mandate is illustrative. Clearly, in the case of a self-insured institution, the Little Sisters of the Poor, or Thomas Aquinas College, for these institutions to command distribution of monies for abortion or contraception would have been formal cooperation with evil and something not to be done. The intention of the end would not have been shared, but integral and essential assistance in the object of the external act was commanded, and they were right to refuse it. But even in the case of ordinary insurance rather than self-insurance, the signing of the waiver constituted a signal which was known to trigger federal coercion on the insurance company to perform an evil act, namely disseminating monies for vice. This constituted a signal ineluctably initiating evil action, just as is true of the lookout who, under threat of death, gives the signal for robbery or assassination. The Obama administration wished to say that all that was involved was signing a form indicating one wished not to cooperate. What could be more innocent? But that's untrue. Suppose, for purposes of argument, we take the case of a person who does not wish to be involved in an unjust execution, who is told that to avoid this, all he has to do is go to the commander of the firing squad and say the words, "I do not wish to be involved." And suppose further that this utterance is itself actually the command to fire, and that the person so directed knows it. Manifestly, he can't then approach the commander of the squad and say, "I don't wish to be involved." Likewise, a Christian told to hold up a sign saying, "I love Jesus," at a particular moment to signal the occasion of an assassination attempt or else die, cannot later plausibly defend himself by saying, "But I really do. I really do love Jesus." We have occasion, don't we? You can hear the argument. You have occasion always, in good season and bad, to pronounce the gospel. All you need to do is do something wholly innocent. This is merely a physical consequence. What is that by comparison with the occasion for the eternal salvation of a soul? That's, nonetheless, this is formal cooperation. Thus, signing the waiver, even apart from the distinctive case of self-insurance, was, in my view, formal cooperation with evil. It was not most formal cooperation, because the intention of the end was not shared. But it was formal cooperation, because it's an essential and proximate signal, ineluctably and singularly initiating evil action. This would have contributed as integrally and essentially to the wrongful object of the external act. Thank you. Well, you can say, look, there's nothing about the transporting of the cross that itself requires the crucifixion as such, but there is a willingness to accept the onus of the affliction under the ratio of justice. So I do think here, one of the things I veered away from here are even more controverted points. For example, it really is a profound question and a necessary question. How do we understand the common good in relation to particular acts? How do we understand the transcendence of the common good, which is also related to whether we consider there to be a hierarchy of events of morally significant ordering events prior to choice or not? And these are even more controverted than the narrow point where we seem often like. Who was it who said of the English and the Americans, you know, two peoples divided by a common language? I mean, there's the narrow kind of precisive reference, but I think the wider reference would be to the common good and the way in which the oblation of Christ in subjecting himself to an unjust penalty is not suicide. It's not suicide, but it does have to do with an order to a transcendent common good. And I think that does affect us here. In question 19, is it Article 9 or Article 10? I forget. I think it's 10. Of the Prima Secunda, Thomas says that every moral act must be chosen under the ratio formally of the common good. So every individual good must be chosen formally under the ratio of that order to the common good. And I suspect transcendence of the common good has to come in here.
Thank you. Could you say something then more about the relationship between formal cooperation and immediate material cooperation? It sounds as though those are two descriptions for the same phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, well, the way many people use the language, what many people want to call immediate material cooperation is, I would say, formal cooperation. So these categories can be used in such a way that we end up making the same judgments. And it's at the time of the mandate, there are many people who said, well, this isn't formal cooperation, but it is immediate material cooperation, and therefore ought not to be done. On the other hand, it also puts it into this category of things that might be acceptable. And if you think that by reason of the form of the action, by reason of the essential causality of the action embraced by the will, that the act is a malum, it seems to me it has to be formal. So, I mean, granted that one can use these categories in such a way that one converges on the same conclusions, I think that it doesn't capture the analysis of action as perfectly as the realization that because the end has this superior causality, to share the intention of the end is most formally to cooperate. But because our will goes up not only to the ratio of appetibility, but to the thing itself that we're doing, that if that itself is disordered, that also is formal cooperation. And one sees this at the margins. I mean, Janet Smith, for example, if you recall, early on argued about the mandate that it looked as though it could be material cooperation that would be licit. And so, in other words, there is a difficulty even, the moment one is speaking of material and not formal, one has made a certain judgment about the nature of the formality of the act. And I'm loath to say that the formality of the act doesn't include the species of the external object. Yes, sir.
Thank you. You mentioned that the primary places in Thomas, in the Summa Theologiae, for the basis on which you've been talking, are prima secunda. Question, I heard you mention question 12, question 18, and then just recently to the last response, you mentioned question 19. Are there any, okay, I have a follow-up question, but are there any other principal, fundamental places that we should look to review
the whole,
what you've been saying?
In a way, you're dealing with the whole first 20 questions of the Prima Secunda, and in fact, you can find it helps to look at earlier treatments where you can find all kinds of. But I mean, if you're looking narrowly, I would say it's those first 20 questions of the Prima Secunda, but also the treatments of the common good that are in various places in the Summa Theologiae and in other works, in the Summa Contra Gentiles, which are it's quite important, right? Because for Thomas, it seems that common good is not merely a conception that comes in with political thought. It's a crucial, formal principle in moral consideration, right? That every individual goodwilled must be formally further ordered to the common good in order that this be good action. So there's a very strong unified teleology here, which one sees at the furthest extent when he says in the Contra Gentiles, God is the common good. That is, there's an order of common goods. Individual goods are ordered to common goods, and the lowest individual good of a higher order may be nobler than the highest, than the common good of a lower order. As Thomas will say, the least grace in the soul is nobler than the whole cosmos, right? So it seems to me this, there are so many questions around this, right, that have arisen, and it's important to work through them. That would be a whole other effort to address that most formally here.
Dr. Long, so good to see you. I did have kind of a question, though. When you were talking about the HHS mandate and, of course, the formal cooperation of companies or institutions that cooperated, but could you explain then for the individual what kind of, like an individual who's just buying health insurance, yeah. Would you explain the difference there?
Well, there's a common good involved again. I mean, I'm steering away from it. There's an issue of the common good. So the individual can assure with 100% accuracy, even if he has a plan that supports abortion or contraception, that he won't use that. And if he has no other way to care for his family, the incremental aid to the insurance company is still falling under the obligation morally to care for his family, right? I mean, it isn't as though by virtue of him having that policy, somebody has to use a contraceptive or abort, or somebody is being aided to do so directly by him. Whereas if I command my insurer, in the case of self-insurance, it's obvious, I have to tell my insurer to do this. And the only reason the courts initially didn't see this was because they have no native, it's incomprehensible to them that someone could think contraception or abortion were like this. But I think when it got to the high court, they realized it, because in the materials that went in the briefs, it was included. And that's why Notre Dame, which was laughed out of court initially, right, because they were permitting this before it was commanded of them. And when they made their initial argument, the judge just laughed them out of court. I can understand. But then they realized, wait a minute, if their confession granted these particular representatives don't seem passionately devoted to what their confession is teaching them to be true. But if you think this to be true, you know, fill in the blank. So I command my insurer, when I don't want to do something, to kill a Jew. No, I don't want to kill a Jew, but I'm commanding my I'm self-insured, and I command the insurer to do it, right? I send the note, and I know that this immediately triggers coercion for him to do this. So how about we make it a nuclear war? You know, I mean, it becomes clear when you think of it as a malum, a grave malum, that there's a problem, right? I mean, for the individual, there's always been this difference, though, right? I mean, for an institution to provide monies for this is different than for an individual to care for his family with absolutely no intention or choice of any wrongful action, right? I mean, if I just want my wife and my children to be covered, to have health insurance, I'm not in any way, either as an end or as a means, embracing an abortifacient or abortion or contraception, etc.
Would that be material?
There's a material, yeah, it's material in the sense in which if I sell my house to somebody who may be morally disordered, somebody can say, well, you're encouraging him. But, I mean, there's nothing about him having a place to live that in and of its, right? I mean, this is, it's remote. Now, you could make it proximate by adding circumstances which would change the relation of the object to reason. You add on circumstances, and you can do this, right? You know that somebody wants a house in order to be a base of operations for a murder. Or, you know, you're selling a handgun, and you know that somebody is talking about using it for murder. Now you've got a different case, right? You have a different case.
Thank you very much for your lecture. You explained that the differences between how we determine the morality of particular cases of cooperation depends upon the former disagreements about action theory. Do you think the same applies to those cases in which we've determined that actually this is not a case of either the most formal or even implicitly formal cooperation, but once you have a case of this is so-called material cooperation. This is a case in which it's not the kind of thing that can't be chosen. But still, there are disagreements about whether or not this is the type of action that you should do.
Can I ask you to repeat this? Because I need to...
No problem. So, once we've determined that a particular case of cooperation is not formal, it's not the kind of thing that can't be done, still, there's a question about, is this a good thing to do?
Oh, sure, right. Sure, that's right, yeah. So by reason of the common good, this might happen.
Right, so can you explain what the resources from Aquinas' action theory, how you would address those questions?
Well, I tend to think of this again in relation to the common good. So suppose that I want something innocent from a vendor, and I can't get this innocent thing from anybody else, but it's not vital, it's simply a good, and this vendor... provides a lot of vicious things. But supposing I know, moreover, that if a few people like me withholding such innocent purchases will drive them into extinction, that this will occur. By reason of the common good, it might be unfitting for me to support them. Right? It might be unfitting for me to support them. When a predator on the common good can so easily be taken out of play if you knew or you had sound prudential ground for holding that, withholding some innocent, right? That would be an illustration. I think the common good comes in a lot, actually. Because it's involved in every moral judgment. I mean, it's not merely a political notion, and it's not merely an instrumental notion, at least in Thomas, nor in Augustine, nor I think even in Gaudium et Spes, where I think they have mistranslated some of it, right? That's a stab.
I've just realized, given our new Thomistic Institute banner here, that Aquinas is looking up to Dr. Steve Long.
No, he's averting his gaze because he can no longer stand my obfuscation.
Let's give our thanks to Dr. Long.
Thank you.